as big and as broad and as tall as any crane or building in the city, stretching higher than their building at home even. There was a clear mark where the water reached up it, where the stone was wet black rather than the dry stone grey above. From inside the megatruck, she could not see how high up it went. For some reason, this tower scared Nona's top and bottom thoughts so terribly that her heart went ka-chunk in her chest. There was a terrible pain in her side and all the way down her arm. The pain was good, because she couldn't think about anything but the pain. The more she thought, the more problems she had. "The hull!" said the captain. "The hole in the road! The hole! The hole! The hole!" Crown was saying something, scrabbling against the back of Nona's chair, scrabbling. Pyrrha and Paul were collapsed on the floor. Nona knew that skidding across the surface of the water was no good, so she looked for one of the big cresting waves, and with the auto-accelerator dinging in her ears, she ploughed the megatruck directly into the water. The river swallowed them up. It felt very heavy. The truck's wheels spun against nothing. The truck groaned horribly from the pressure, creaking like Nona's hurting heart, and they sank like a stone. The cabin darkened as they sank. The windshield wipers bowed and sagged away from the windshield, and then were suddenly ripped off, sucked into the current, and a soft white starry crack appeared at the edge of the glass. Nona slithered again, fumbling for the accelerator with her foot, but she couldn't take her hands off the wheel. She was exhausted. She did not want to drive any more. Seeing the tower had taken the fight out of her top and her bottom, and now out of her middle too. She looked down the side of the chair, and there was Paul, struggling across the floor and shaking blood out of Camilla's right ear. Paul, face calm and even and only a little cross-eyed. Paul reached out to put one hand on the dirty accelerator and looked up at her, not beseeching, only waiting. "Can you get us to the ninth house?" they said. There was another awful shriek of metal somewhere in the back of the megatruck. The windscreen darkened all the time. The water was turbid and filthy, and the air in the cabin was getting weirdly chill. Lots of people were yelling. She could hear Pyrrha in the background, Crown struggling with the captain. "Yes," said Nona, "but..." "But?" How could she say that she was so tired, that whatever was going on in her chest was so incredibly urgent that if she closed her eyes and let it happen, she could probably die right there, right then? How to say that she wanted to go as Nona, with all her thoughts and feelings being Nona feelings, which might only be about 6 months old and therefore not very good, but were still her own. What could she do with the little selfish thought that now Camilla and Palamedes were gone, even if they had left behind Paul, which was probably quite nice of them, and Pyrrha was broken somehow? It was hard to want to live, hard to want everyone else to live, even lovely Crown. The captain was gone, forever probably, and it didn't matter about the corpse prince, who was dead already and therefore used to it. Nona swallowed. She let her eyelids nearly touch, which would have been the end. "But maybe we shouldn't," she said, holding the eyelids to that little slit, watching the on-screen scribbles flash urgently on the truck glass, watching the widening white crack, watching the river water pound itself into the place where it wanted to be, even if the river itself didn't. "If we end here, it'll be just like a bad dream, won't it? And maybe we'll wake up somewhere else. I know we won't," she explained, "but we don't have to know that. Maybe if we all go, it'll be quick." Paul looked at her, with those dark, grey-brown pupils widening slightly. "Nona," they said. "Noodles in the back." The middle thoughts surged. The slit widened all the way. "Oh, my God," she said in a panic. "I forgot about Noodle." The windshield cracked all the way across the middle. Paul leant their full weight on the accelerator. Nona drove the truck home. 31. The water disappeared. There was a huge squealing of tyres. Paul eased off the accelerator just in time, and a big gravelly noise as the tyres, going from water to pressure to nothing to a big field of gritty stone, spun the stone in all directions. The windshield cracked all the way through, and the truck bounced once, and a whole stream of red text blinked up on the screen overlay. But the light that came through the windshield wasn't grey light, and in fact, wasn't very bright at all. It was a thin electric yellow light that did very little to pierce the darkness. The megatruck horn honked itself, and Nona was only aware of the sound, its echo, the blaring wail. Then she became aware of something else, an insistent tugging at top thought, bottom thought, and middle thought. She wanted something. She didn't know quite what it was, only she wanted it. Quite like a bathroom thought in its insistency. Headlights, someone was saying. Get the headlights. Paul had staggered up from behind her and was moving to the back cabin, unlocking the door. Pyrrha said, We've equalized. We're on level ground. And then, in the corner of Nona's vision, the corpse prince rose. She leant over the driver's seat, through the electric light, peering out at whatever was there. Then she suddenly cut off a word in her mouth. She followed after Paul. Pyrrha was saying, Where are we? Back in the tunnel? And Nona felt Pyrrha's strong, ropey arms circle around, felt herself lifted up and out of the driver's seat, found she was mucky with sweat, which embarrassed her, and that the warmth of Pyrrha's arms was distant and far away. She could barely remember walking, moving her body in the chair, doing all that driving. She was grateful now for being carried. She felt lifted through the cabin, floating above a high chatter of voices in the megatruck behind. Forget to check on the engine, a big hit like that in the fuel cells. All right. Sprained, not broken, surely. Thanagenic, someone else was saying. I felt it immediately, like a warm shower. Since when have you had warm? There was a shrill volley of barks. Noodle. Nona was weak and grateful to hear Noodle. There was a big release sound, a metal sliding door, and one, two, heave, followed by a great metal clashing. Nona struggled to sit up in Pyrrha's arms and open her eyes, and she saw the blackness out the other side of the door and heard the sizzling, steaming sound as water boiled off the sides of the megatruck and felt a blast of arctic air, black, cold, dust-smelling air, the blackest and coldest she had ever felt in her life. The prince strode down the platform. She stood on the gravel, haloed in the underlights from the wheezing megatruck, and she said, Home, sweet home. Pyrrha clattered her way down the platform. Nona looked up. They were standing at the bottom of some enormous rocky shaft. There was a tiny square of light way up top, as though they were standing at the bottom of a hole. All the steam was boiling off the truck upward. There was a soup of white, cloudy stuff, and then a navy expanse of night, of space. She knew she should feel cold, as her body was feeling cold. But it was more the memory of a sensation than sensation itself. Paul trotted up alongside Pyrrha and stared at the filigreed back of the standing, gazing prince and said, Gideon, where are we? Top tier, shuttle field, said the corpse prince, smack bang in the middle. Nona, said Paul, well done. Nona did not feel as though she had done anything warranting a well done. She had just driven the truck, and she nearly gave up on that. She said drearily, I didn't do it on purpose. Pyrrha said, No Lictor could have taken us here that precisely. I'm not sure John could manage it. Then again, I'm not sure of John, period. Gideon and I couldn't have. Though, for one thing, this field wasn't around in my day. You used to land at the installation they made the prison out of and go down from there in the elevator. What the hell was that in the river? That wasn't number 7. Prince Kirionagaya had walked several steps away from them into the darkness, and now seemed to float in the gloom, ghost-like in her pure white clothes. She had drawn her sword, and she didn't turn around. "Quiet," she said. Noodle ignored her totally. Inside the truck he was doing the regular bark, bark, bark of a dog alerted to a nearby threat. Everyone else obediently stayed silent for a few seconds.
"I don't hear anything," said Pyrrha, neutrally.
"Nor I," said Paul.
Kiriona made a noise that sounded almost amused and said,
"Fine, I'm going. Keep up or you're probably dead."
Then she crunched away over the gravel and dwindled out of sight. Pyrrha and Paul exchanged glances. Paul scrambled back up the ramp of the truck and said something to the people inside. There was a short discussion. Nona's hearing had gone very fuzzy and she couldn't make out any words, but no one was shouting. And then Paul dropped back down and the ramp began to scrape upward into its housing. Pyrrha adjusted her grip on Nona's body, shifting her weight, and then set off with Paul in the direction the corpse prince had gone.
"No push?" asked Pyrrha.
"She has to stay with AIM," said Paul, "and AIM got knocked around in the crash. They'll be fine."
"Honestly, I was hoping for another gun," said Pyrrha.
"How are the sixth doing? Is Juno?" "We're out of the beast's radius. That's enough thanagy to go around. That truck has multiple highly capable necromancers and a dog. Worry about us instead."
"I do," said Pyrrha.
They walked for a long time. Nona felt like she wanted to sleep, but she was very frightened of sleeping. Somewhere in her spine was that same weird, insistent urge or twinge. She noticed, vaguely, that Paul and Pyrrha weren't talking to her anymore. They weren't talking to each other either, just trudging steadily on through the darkness. Once upon a time, Pyrrha would have jollied her along, made bad jokes or said things like,
"Right, kitty, another minute and then you're carrying me."
Now it was almost like they didn't think Nona was awake, even though her eyes were open. The only time anyone spoke during the journey was when Pyrrha suddenly said,
"Fucking dark in here."
"Yes," said Paul, as if this was something intriguing that Pyrrha had been clever to notice.
"Ninth house ambience, you reckon?"
"No."
"Someone should have told Anastasia that a string of fairy lights wouldn't have gone amiss. They could shape 'em like little skulls, stay on brand. Then again, she always said the skull was the least interesting bone."
As they walked farther, Nona felt the twinge getting stronger. And she felt something else. Something at once familiar and unpleasant, squirming far off in the darkness. She strained her thoughts toward it. Many things, small things, things she'd seen before once, but didn't feel up to seeing again. Grey shapes swam in front of her eyes in the darkness. She thought she saw the side of Pyrrha's face. She did see the side of Pyrrha's face, because it was getting lighter. They were walking toward a light. A cold white glow somewhere ahead of them, down a tunnel, getting closer and closer. They arrived in a room. It was a big circular room with dark stone walls. There were arched niches in the walls, and each one held a seated skeleton in a dark, shapeless robe. Nona could see all of this because there was a powerful electric lantern, rather like one of the truck's headlights, placed on the floor, throwing long spiked shadows out in all directions. The corpse prince, Kirionagaya, was standing in the middle of the room with her drawn sword turned wet and red partway up the blade. There were crumpled dead bodies discarded around her, six or seven that Nona could see, all bundled up in black fabric like the skeletons were wearing. At the back of the room was a rectangular cage, taller than a man and made of wrought iron like the park fences. Slumped against the outside of this cage was a large person in strange, battered metal armour, tangled in his own black robes. He was quite simply the oldest person Nona had ever seen, and Nona had always collected old people in much the same way as she collected dogs. The old people at the dairy and the old man at the fishmonger's and the old women who worked at the car repair place. He was older than any of them. His whole face looked like it was trying to escape its skeleton. Dark red blood had spread out around him in a pool. His antique head rolled sideways to look past Kiriona at Pyrrha, at Nona, and he said in a voice that creaked with agonized, reverential awe,
my lady, you have come home to us at last.
Paul dropped to the ancient man's side and started looking him over, pulling away the tangled black cloth from the body, revealing a series of livid gashes down the neck, a puncture mark through the chest. The old man raised a hoary-looking fist and, without saying a word, boxed Paul soundly around the ears.
"Leave me!" he wheezed sharply. "Interloper, stranger, fool, do nothing for me, touch me not!"
"Leave him," said the corpse prince. Paul said, "No, I can save him easily, it's only shock and blood loss."
Kiriona wiped her sword clean on one of the black-shrouded bodies. Then she kicked it over with her beautiful polished boot.
"Look at that," she said, "and trust me on this one."
Beneath the light of the powerful lamp, the dead person's face was startling. The eyelids hung slack, and there were rows of dark purple pinpricks above and below them, like something fine and sharp had come through. Hanging out of the eyelids, Nona at first did not know what she was looking at, was a shriveled object, wet and red, like a slug, like a mussel. The tongue hanging out of the mouth was a lot longer than a normal tongue, and pointed, triangular, deep blue in death. For some reason, the sight started a shudder at Nona's feet that carried on all the way up to the top of her head. The awful pain tightened in her chest and nearly shuddered her out of her body. The back of her neck itched so badly it felt as though it were bleeding. Pyrrha said a word so terrible under her breath that it startled Nona back into the middle ground of her thoughts. She rebuked, "Pyrrha," and then,
"No, I'm sorry. You're allowed to say whatever you like at this point."
Paul was crouched, staring thoughtfully at the dead, empty-eyed face in a way that would have been strange for either Palamedes or Camilla. Nona thought Camilla would have looked with eyes like stone and given away nothing, and that Palamedes would have reached out to touch. Paul did not reach out to touch, and Paul looked as though it were interesting. The corpse prince said tightly,
"They shouldn't be here. We would have gotten word if they were back in the home system. They're confined to Antioch. He said they'd only be on Antioch. God damn it, he said!"
Paul said, "Gideon, I've seen this before. My memory's split.
Where?"
"Silas Octokyzeron's poor bastard cavalier," said Kiriona. "Column ashed." "I didn't understand then. We call them devils. I mean, Dad calls them devils. This is what we're facing on Antioch."
"Fuck me, I didn't think. This is mental. They can't be here. He said they couldn't travel. He said..."
Paul said, "Gideon, cool it. Why can't I heal this man?"
"Like this I am undesirable to them," croaked the figure.
"They bit him," said the corpse prince, as though nobody had spoken. "I mean, they hit him. They don't have to bite. It's revenant magic. They're waiting for him to die so they don't have to work so hard. Heal him up now and they'll still ride that wound all the way into his hideous old body and I'll get to kill him myself."
The ancient old man turned his single, rheumy, hateful eye to the corpse prince.
"I would that you had been carried back here on a stretcher," he said. "I would that you were stretched out before me, dead in the rudeness of you. Your niche is ready, Gideon Nav, and now I cannot clasp the joy of laying you within it."
He coughed fretfully, batted another metal-fisted hand at Paul, who had instinctively surged forward, and he said,
"Look at you, you cock-o'-the-walk, you filigree piglet, you gum, a whited sepulchre, ninth blood on your foreign sword.
Nona was distracted from her lazy enjoyment of the word piglet by a flicker in the dark archway, the one from which they'd just emerged. She felt again that strange sense of the familiar made awful, like coming back to your own bed and finding it covered in stains and slimes that hadn't been there when you left it. She clutched feebly at Pyrrha's forearm. "There's more," she said. "More outside." Pyrrha's muscles tensed. Paul and Kiriona both looked back at the archway. Something moved, deep in the shadows.
"Thanks, Kitty," said Pyrrha. "Nav, let's get that cage open and head down. Sorry, Gramps, we're on a clock."
Paul crossed to the metal cage and started fiddling with the sort of heavy latch mechanism on the front. Kiriona hovered, sword still in her hand, staring at the archway.
"Nav, come on," said Pyrrha sharply. "Any kid in the cohort knows the mission comes first. Or did you get that uniform out of the dress-up box?"
Kiriona rounded on Pyrrha, her gold eyes cold and haughty. But instead of saying anything, she shoved her sword back into its scabbard and moved to the cage as well. Paul had freed the latch and was hauling back the barred gate with an echoing clatter. Inside was a bare and empty metal box, a bit smaller than their old bathroom back in the apartment. Once the gate was partly open, Paul and Kiriona set about dragging the dying old man into the box. This was a messy and difficult process. Not only did he leave a great smeared slick of blood behind him, but he kept coughing, flailing his arms and calling them both
"dunghill pups in need of a sound whipping,"
and other things that were clearly not meant to be kind. Nona felt bad. Not only could she not help, but she was keeping Pyrrha from helping. She risked a glance back at the archway. There was a figure there. Dark robes topped by a pale face, not moving forward but swaying slightly on the spot. It looked as if it were watching them. Its eyes writhed. Paul positioned the old man against the back wall of the metal box, then snatched the lamp. Kiriona retrieved a sword that had been left lying in the blood nearby, brought it in and dropped it unceremoniously in the man's lap. Then Pyrrha carried Nona into the box, and Kiriona heaved the gate shut with a clash. Two more figures had appeared in the archway, flanking the first.
"Hope we've still got power," Paul said.
"The breaker," said Kiriona. "Big switch there on the wall. Ought to work unless they've killed it from below."
Paul yanked the handle she had pointed at. A small glass bump above the handle lit up with a sickly red glow. There was a heavy mechanical clonk. The floor jolted, and the stone floor started to rise up the side of the bars, blood trickling over its edge and dripped down, a few drops spattering on the metal tiles. The floor went higher and higher until it closed off the window of bright light from above, and they were all in darkness, except for the faint redness from the indicator bulb. The old man's breathing rasped and laboured, and machinery rumbled somewhere over their heads. There was a low, whirring moan and a rush of freezing cold air. At first, Nona thought she would never see again. Then she found her eyes adjusting after all.
"Please, sir," Paul was saying patiently.
He had crouched back down next to the old man in the blood.
"If you stop trying to hit me, I can at least do something for the pain."
"The Marshal loves pain," said Kiriona.
She was staring fixedly at the red bulb. The old man gurgled.
"Seneschal, you fool!"
"Oh, congrats! I forgot Nona Jesimus left you in charge," said Kiriona. "Where's Iglamini?"
"Dead," the Seneschal said.
Kiriona became very still. The Seneschal wheezed with relish at her expression. Even in the darkness, Nona could still tell and surprised herself by saying to Kiriona,
"He's lying."
"Dead, as far as I care," he amended. "She went on ahead to the monument."
"Nav, talk to me," said Pyrrha. "Antioch, you've been fighting these
Things? How long?
Fuck knows, said Kiriona, highly distracted. 3, 4 months? Took us a while to work out what they even were. Thought they only had a weird disease.
And how long have they been on the ninth?
This was addressed to the Seneschal.
A night? A day? Said the rasping old man. You hold the reverend daughter, so I must answer. We shut them away, locked some of them inside their cells. They riot. Their touch consumes. They hunger for the youngest of us.
Boy, are they out of luck, said the corpse prince, sotto voce.
Their bodies twist. They do not know how to use their bodies,
Crux rasped, as though Kiriona had not spoken.
Some of them are dead-walking. Those are the weaker kind. Sisters Lacrimorta and Isomorta plied their art to some effect. The constructs were safe. Fleshed corpses they took, but the bones they wanted none of.
Paul said, How many are like this?
Too many.
Can I get too many in numbers?
Over 200. Full 40 lie dead at the bottom of the tiers where they were pushed in the first hour. It was all we could do to secure the tier. More have died. The marshal reckoned we lost a full 100 already. And,
added the old man sourly,
now those 7 above are added to the beer by my own blade and the striplings.
Those were dead already, Kiriona interrupted. The dead ones moved differently. You realise the ones you shoved off the tier probably just got back up again. Can the living ones be cured? Asked Paul. You can't cure this, said the prince. It's spirit shit, possession. You can ward people so they don't get grabbed if you're really good, but otherwise chop them up and burn the bits. That's the cure. Civilian or Edenite or house, it makes no difference. There was another great jolt that shook the metal box. The Seneschal grunted. Nona realised they were no longer moving downward. The cage doors opened to a floor of more cages, like the world's strangest zoo. Machines of a kind Nona had never seen. Nothing like the nice normal machines back home. Enormous edifices gated behind iron bars, as though someone were afraid they would get out. They all droned away. Their bars had been strung with long streamers of black cloth that seemed so old and tattered and frail that they might dissolve if you breathed on them. Pyrrha murmured, God, this place has gone downhill. But thankfully, only Nona heard it. The dying old man rasped,
We barricaded behind the Anastasian. Sister Canacy and Deacon Davith were left here. Why have they abrogated their duty?
Holy shit! Sister Canacy is still alive, said Kiriona, startled. She used to oversee me on OSS duty. If you're using Sister Canacy as a last line of defence, how bad off are we, you?
Sister Canacy, you cancerous gosling, you bloodied slime, has what you have always lacked, burbled Crux wetly. Faith and loyalty.
Probably. But I have what Sister Canacy always lacked, which is knees that work, said Kiriona. The old man ignored this.
Nobody down here was touched. Nobody down here was taken. Canacy and Davith should remain. This is our place of safety. It has never been breached, he added.
With a look that said he thought the assembled and unlovely throng in front of him were in danger of counting as a breach. Pyrrha said,
Well, the chambers down through the main artery ought to hold up. There's that long tunnel with the blast doors on either side.
This seemed to fox Crux.
Who are you, foreigner, that you know the mysteries of the Anastasian?
I was here before it was the Anastasian, said Pyrrha absently. Painted the nursery, mint green.
Look.
If your watchers aren't here, they've pulled back behind whatever bailey you've set up. Let's keep moving. How are we going to move?
But Paul had already gone to the old man, lying bloodied on the bottom of the platform. The huge, horrible, ancient, dwarfed Camilla Hecht's lithe, solid form easily. But, much to Nona's surprise, Paul heaved him up to standing as though he were Nona, or even smaller, like he was Kevin. Crux howled out,
"This shames the Ninth!"
"Not possible," said the corpse prince. But Paul said, "We can move this way, but I can't fight at the same time." "Nuff, take point. I'll take the rear," said Pyrrha, to which the corpse prince said,
"Nice!"
And Nona laughed out loud. She felt a little drunk and strange. At that laugh, the old man stared at her in frank dismay and reproof. Then his face closed up somehow, left off its look of horror and awe, and he looked at her with a totally different expression. He really did look like a skeleton mask, with his age-spotted pate and his deeply shadowed bitter eye. Nona looked away and found that the corpse prince had looked at her briefly too, again with an expression even Nona couldn't translate. Pyrrha held her close and said,
"Can't be doing that badly if you're going to laugh at an us joke."
Nona did not want to tell her that something terrible was going on in her body, and had been ever since the period where her heart and her arm had hurt. She snuggled down into the halo of Pyrrha's arms for warmth. She was starting to feel blue all over, and the zip fastener of Pyrrha's jacket caught her arm and scratched her. She stared mildly at the rough red greys and the little square flaps of skin that had risen off her arm. The corpse prince held the lantern before her as they moved down that long, toe-curlingly cold tunnel. The strong white light glimmered off rough, unfinished stone and the softer gleam of very old metal and paint. And Nona got the fright of her life, seeing shapes on the walls, until she realised that it was more bones that had been glued into the rock face. It was awful. A yell echoed down the tunnel, and they all startled, but they reached the end of the tunnel where what seemed to be huge white bars had been pressed into service over the doorway. As the light from the end of the tunnel and their light dazzled each other, Nona realised that what she had taken for painted white metal was fresh, slightly pink bone, redder at either end where it had planted itself into the doorframe. There were more huddled, black-wrappered old people peering between the bones, their anxious faces blurred with painted masks. White bone, black background. "Halt!" quavered someone, but the corpse prince said, "It's me. Where's Iglamini?" The most asymmetrical person that Nona had ever seen in her short life stumped to life behind the bars. At her barked command, the bars parted, sort of twanged away and opened up in the exact way that bars shouldn't, exposing the cortex of the bone. Now Nona could see her clearly. Most of her face had rippled in the way that hot sauces would someday ripple when she was 80 to 200 years older, like a candle that had burned for hours before someone blew it out. A proud, keen-eyed face peered out behind that melt. One of her legs wasn't her own. It went on funny at the hip, Nona noticed, but she held herself as tall and as proud as Crown. In her hands was a huge black metal pike, about the same height as her, with an edge that gleamed in the light. Nona couldn't stop herself looking at that edge. For some reason, it made her palms sweat and the back of her neck itch again. The woman barked, "The Seneschal needs help! Get Asya and Brother Clement, now!"
"You're a fool and a twit, and your brains have turned, Iglamini," rasped the old man. "I would have kept the doors barred against me in case I had been compromised."
"Good point. Get someone with a spear. Treat him at arm's length. Spear him through if anything happens." "Spear him through if anything doesn't," the woman added beneath her breath. "Yes, Marshal," said one of the robed onlookers. "Yes, Captain Iglamini," said another, robed over rusting armour. Crux lashed out at them as he had lashed out at Paul, though at least he had left off lashing out at Paul. He snarled,
"Can you see, Davith, they have abandoned their post. They have been taken or fled. They have gone back up another route, Perhaps the blocked-up ways, or the people.
Cease worrying. Sister Canacy and Deacon Davith are not the types to abandon their post, said the old soldier. I'll send people to check. We're safe down here, so leave your maunderings, or the youth will start to think your dotage is on you already. You see secrets and conspiracies in every corner now.
Brat, toy soldier, Harridan, ground out Crux.
And then he was hustled through the arch, with Paul supporting. The old soldier, they called Iglamini, watched him go, with her face caught up in some worry. He's too old to walk that one off, she muttered to herself. But then she shook herself back to the situation at hand and looked critically at Pyrrha. Her gaze swept over Nona, her gaze fixed briefly on the corpse prince, then back to Nona. I've never seen this many nuns before, said the corpse prince, who didn't sound excited about it. Iglamini said, Sister Berta, hold, and passed the pike on to a rather gloomy-looking girl who looked not much older than Honesty. Berta could barely hold the thing, and someone else came up to help her struggle with it. Then the old woman said, The ninth house welcomes back its sainted reverend daughter. To Nona's horror, whole and entire, Iglamini dropped to her one native knee. Behind her, in ones, then twos, then threes, every robed old person or medium person or even quite young person, glancing sidelong at their fellows, dropped to the floor. Only hapless Sister Berta remained upright, and her fellow helping her with the pike. The call moved back through the broad, dark room behind them. Reverend daughter, the reverend daughter, the sainted daughter. Nona's horror only grew when she realised that it was not Kiriona Gaia they were referring to, but her. Iglamine rose from one knee. It took a long time, but she quelled with a look anyone who offered to help, and then stumped forward into the ring of light flung by the corpse prince's lantern. She reached out. She touched the side of the prince's face. They both recoiled. Kiriona Gaia recovered first. You always said I'd come back in a box, Iglamini, she said lightly. They killed you, said Iglamini. Crime of opportunity, said the corpse prince, and don't tell Crux. I absolutely, positively cannot give him the fucking satisfaction. Iglamini shoved her square in the chest with the palm of one gloved hand. Kiriona tottered a little and wheezed. Don't! That's where my heart used to be. But the old soldier's gaze had already fallen upon Nona. Nona cringed back in Pyrrha's arms, because the expression was as bad as every single time Camilla had caught her putting a mouthful of chewed-up food in the potted plant or elsewhere. She could read this very old, very furious soldier like a book. The woman was angry and blamed her. Kiriona Gaia could read her too, because she insinuated herself between them and said coolly, It's not her, Captain. It's only her body. Over the prince's shoulder, Iglamine looked at Nona, long and suspiciously. Then she sighed and wheeled around and said, Get inside. Now, complete the gate, she told a few of the other robed people. With her back still to the group, she said, Nav, rest assured, I would give you the beating of your life and death if we were not under terrible siege. I don't know why you're here, I don't know why you came back, but if we have the time later and the ninth house survives, I will ask pertinent questions. For now, only give me information if I need it.
We need to get through to the rock, said Pyrrha.
Iglamine turned to look at Pyrrha. But Pyrrha, as per usual, was completely unmoved by any hostile, gimlet-eyed expression. Iglamine said slowly, You ask me, in the middle of the worst emergency my house has ever faced, to let strangers through to our holiest of holies?
Yes, we have a lictor's rights, said Pyrrha.
The old soldier sharpened, face alight with something that Nona could tell wasn't hope, but was in the same room, at least the same building.
She looked over Pyrrha again. Pyrrha in her ordinary jacket and her ordinary clothes with her very ordinary guns and her extraordinary scruff on her jaw, and she said dubiously,
"Your Grace."
"I said a lictor's rights, not a lictor's prowess, sir."
"Captain."
"Marshal," I Glamine corrected, "but I ranked captain before discharge."
"Territorials."
"Strike force for my sins."
"You look too sensible for a brandishment, baby," said Pyrrha, her most winning smile in her voice,
and the old soldier made a noise that was second cousin to a laugh.
"And there's a term I haven't heard since I was a child."
Then I Glamine bristled, as though she had dropped her guard too far, and said,
"Can you save us or not?"
"If you let us through to the rock, maybe."
"But where's the reverend daughter, who we have taken as saint and lictor? Why the tomb?"
There was no smile in Pyrrha's voice now. In fact, she sounded a lot like we suffer with her best radio voice on.
"Captain, perhaps you'll understand me if I tell you this is a matter of the Emperor's intelligence."
But this just made I Glamine laugh again, and not with a bit of humour in it.
"Ha! Don't come over all intelligence agent with me, you young fool. The Bureau's not welcome in the House of the Ninth. Last one we had, 30 years back, we dropped off 11 hours from the prison with 10 hours worth of air and told them to hurry up."
I Glamine looked at Nona. Nona felt unhappy again, hot in her cheeks and under her shirt. The old soldier looked at her critically, like a stranger, and added,
"Take her in. Get her to a heater, slowly, and warm her through. She's taking a chill."
"Nona doesn't chill," said Pyrrha.
But she shifted Nona around in her arms, and in a slightly different voice said,
"Fuck me, Nona, you are cold."
Before Nona could protest that, in fact, she felt quite warm now, too warm for her jacket, Pyrrha moved into the depths of the room. It was a long oblong and resembled nothing so much as a graveyard for rusting swords and things. Rocky niches carved into the walls were filled with old tarnished rubbish and long fearsome slabs of rock, only there were robed people of all kinds perching on top of them, which gave them a kind of picnic aspect. Dim overhead lights hung in cages just like the machines of before, and bright lamps. No candlelight, though Nona could see branches of old dribbly candles with black tapers and horrible brownish tallow, made weird shadows of everyone. Pyrrha shouldered her through surprised skeleton faces and surprised skeleton people. Nona was deeply horrified to see actual walk-around skeletons mixed in with the crowd, when she had mistaken them in the dark for people who were very thin. When they turned around, they were skulls with pinprick red lights dancing in the hollows of their eye sockets. She was fascinated, horribly so, but had no time to be. Pyrrha broke the soft, worried hush by saying, "Palamedes, Paul." And then Nona was laid down next to a glowing red bar heater that smelled like oil and burning hair, displacing a couple of creaking old people who couldn't get out of the way fast enough because they kept bowing to her. One kissed her shoe.
Even Kevin knew better than that.
She said reproachfully, "That's unhygienic, there's germs." But they were gone already. The terrible old man was there too. He was being tended to by Paul and continuing to heap great curses upon their head, which Paul was taking with calm imperturbability. Another, shorter person stood alongside, holding a knife as though they wished very much that they weren't. Nona was laid down on the hard, cold rock. Pyrrha had taken her hands and was warming them between her own. Nona's were a strange, livid colour. Nona could see confusion in the shape of Pyrrha's eyebrows and mouth, and when she ran her hands up Nona's forearms, the confusion changed.
"When did you get this?" she demanded.
She was pointing at the very slight mark on Nona's forearm, still a little pink from where the skin had lifted. "I got it off your zip," she said, and then she realised,
"My first wound." Paul?
Said Pyrrha, desperately. But Paul had already transferred his attentions from the old man to Nona. Paul was touching the back of her neck, checking her eyes, behind her ears, sticking a finger briefly in her mouth, moving down to slide a hand underneath her armpits. Nona looked away and found the hideous old man looking directly at her with that same expression in his bleary, pain-trammelled eyes of recognition. He wanted something, from her specifically.
Lady, he said in a much softer creak, you've gone away again, my lady. Where have you run? Remember your catechism and your lesson, and remember them well now. This is where you come back to. You have your little escape. You'll feel better for coming back. You remember that Harrowhark?
Nona whispered. I'm sorry. I'm not Harrowhark.
Aye, and you've said that before, said the old man. Who are you this time, if not my Lady Harrowhark?
Nona shut her eyes. The darkness closed in around her, unrelieved by the bar heater and the lamps set all around and the caged lights swinging overhead and the press of people crammed into that long, dusty, abandoned room. She was outside the room. She was outside the great tunnel. She was looking down at the terrible, dead, grey and white surface, the great, hollow pools set into rock. Then she went back down, pulled down into each cavern, the long central shaft deeper and deeper. Her middle thoughts crawled into her top and bottom thoughts. For a moment, she thought she'd die of it.
There's a box, she said, and there's someone in the box who isn't me. I'm me. I don't know who's in that box, not really, only when you open it, I'll be gone because I can't survive knowing. And I think, inside that box, there's something that looks like a girl.
The face of the old man blurred. Paul was saying, her healing mechanism stopped. The body doesn't have enough of anything to keep going. Her brain's seizing. A couple of organs have collapsed. Massive trauma. Interesting.
Paul, said Pyrrha, your bedside manner is bullshit.
It's interesting. It's not great. Nona, how do you feel?
Good, said Nona. Fine, honesty compelled her to say. Worried and a little sad, but good. I'm fine. The body's not.
Okay, ecstatic seizure. Anyway, she's static, not regressing. She's not healing, but she's not going downhill. We have to get her soul back in.
No,
finished Pyrrha. 5 minutes ago, for preference, said Paul. Nona reached out. She found Camilla's wrist, a wrist she had loved so keenly, attached to hands that had bathed her and flipped the pages of magazines to read to her and spooned out food she didn't want to eat. She looked up into the face of the woman who was gone, which had been shared by a man who was also gone, a face taken by someone new. She said, the more I go back, the more I'm made to go back. It'll hurt her. She wasn't made for it. She's not the right shape.
Don't talk. Don't stress yourself, said Paul.
But Nona didn't want to be interrupted.
I might not help you when... I'm back, she said, not quite understanding. I'll be different. I'll remember everything. I'll remember the thing I'm trying to forget. And Palamedes. I won't love him. I won't love Camilla or Pyrrha or Hot Sauce or even Noodle. I won't love anything. I won't know how. I won't be me at all, or I'll be the me who knows the thing, and knowing the thing means I'm not Nona, I'm someone else.
Paul, practical, clasped one of her hands between them and used the other to rub a rough section of black frieze over her sides to try to warm her up.
Okay, don't worry, they said.
Nona felt hot and cross.
I've just told you why I'm worried in detail, and I think that matters quite a lot.
Camilla and Palamedes were loved by Nona, said Paul, Pyrrha was loved by Nona. It's finished. It's done. You can't take loved away. We loved you too. Palamedes and Camilla loved you. Pyrrha was there too, floating into view above Nona's head in the darkness. Her mouth was set in that unmistakable need-a-cigarette shape.
Don't worry, kiddie, she said tiredly. I'll keep loving you. My problem is I don't know how to stop. And you know who you are, were. You're capable of more than you think right now. I liked you. He liked you. Gideon liked you. My necromancer and I always liked you. And hey, what's like except a love that hasn't been invited indoors? She reached down and ruffled Nona's short hair. Nona felt her borrowed heart go thump-a-thump-a-thump.
But you didn't get me a 6-month birthday present, she whispered pathetically. I didn't get the beach party, or a cake, or any dogs.
Honey, of course I got you a birthday present, said Pyrrha instantly. I bought one the morning of the broadcast. I went and got you a new T-shirt, the expensive kind, not the ones that dissolve when you wash them. I hid it in the sink cabinet. Nona sucked in a breath.
Tell me about it, she whispered. Describe it exactly.
Said Pyrrha, and flicked her eyes up at Paul. Okay, so I hadn't cleared this with the powers that be, but it was a picture of a mustache, like the facial hair, but a cartoon, and then there were words below. Look, you had to see it. I'm not sure I can describe it in a way that...
Pyrrha, I want to know what it said.
Now Pyrrha avoided Paul's gaze.
It's advertised cheap mustache rides, said Pyrrha. We're talking low prices.
Nona started to cry softly, overwhelmed. Paul said, Palamedes wouldn't have let her wear that outside the house. Then, Camilla wouldn't have let her wear it inside either.
Yeah, but what about you, said Pyrrha. Her choice, said Paul. I think mustache rides should be free.
It would have been my favourite present except for the handkerchief, said Nona breathlessly. I'm going to go back and fetch it. I'll remember. I'll make myself remember. And I'll wear it all the time, inside the house and outside the house, and then you'll know it's really me. I'm not going to be gone forever. I'm ready. I'm ready. Let's go.
32.
Aglamine met them at a little nondescript door out of the oblong. Paul had supported the awful old man. He had demanded his rights as seneschal, and they had met the corpse prince, who was pacing at the doorway. Pyrrha had wrapped Nona in one of the big black cloaks, which were much warmer than they looked, but smelled as old as the room, sort of dusty and fusty and mildewy. But she was finding she had to smell quite consciously now, to make her brain understand what she was trying to do. It was like having your feet slip off the pedals of a bicycle. Aglamine, lantern held high, led them down a long, winding passage. She took endless back-and-forth turns until, at one last door, she stopped. She turned off the lantern and plunged them into big, black, icy darkness. Pyrrha said,
We're going in blind.
There is no light of electric or fat in this place, croaked out the old man. There is no light but that which was given to us, not before the rock and the tomb. This is the place you should not be travelling, none of us but the daughter and her cavalier.
Nona could make out nothing in the darkness, but the corpse prince's voice was unmistakable. The reverend daughter has no cavalier living. There was a metal sound. The door opened and Nona was carried over the threshold into a big empty void. The air changed, cold as ice, black and blue as paint. Everyone's feet suddenly made a big squelch. A light flicked on, a tall, bright lantern with a huge glowing bulb within. They were standing in a huge room, a cathedral cave, with a great roundish cold stone rock placed at what was obviously the mouth of a tunnel leading away. A rock the size and height of a big car, and probably the weight of multiple cars. And standing before the rock, a lantern by one booted foot, was Crown. Nona's eyes had been tricked by the light. It wasn't Crown. It was someone exactly Crown's height. Someone with Crown's face. But like someone had washed her in hot water and soaked the colour out. A Crown who gangled without any of Crown's lovely curvy softnesses or bignesses. A wretched white Crown. A Crown with an arm that was all bones. Metal-shod bones, real moving bones, with bony gold fingers holding a tiny pinpoint of orange light. Nona realised that it really was her arm, that it really was a cigarette. Pyrrha startled forward, but there was another squelch. They had all stepped into a soft, jammy yellow field of what looked like cannoline, but more transparent, and Pyrrha was stuck fast. Paul stuck fast, and Crux with them, and Iglamine stuck fast, and the Corpse Prince. "How'd you get here before me?" she demanded. "Didn't. Got here after," said the thing. And it had Crown's voice, too, the same silvery musical sweetness of Crown's, but not nice at all. "I simply looked for any signs of God and slithered downward. Easy, Pappy. This place is like a neon sign saying John Gaius was here. And now, I am afraid, I am here to scotch all your plans. Don't move, please, Sextus. Hectus? They suggested silkily. Paul had moved to support the horrifying old man. The yellow stuff was creeping up above both of their ankles, holding them fast. I don't know what you are yet, but you know what I am, so stay put, Sext. It's Paul, said Paul. I respect that, but can't admire it, said the new person, taking a long drag. Paul said, This is interesting stuff underfoot, Tridentarius. What is it? Adipose fat and mucous membrane, said the Knot Crown modestly. It's my own recipe. Oh my God, Ianthe, barf, said the Corpse Prince. The only person not stuck in this mix was Nona, who was being carried. But the fields spread out far enough in front of them that Nona, who did not think she could walk anyway, would probably get one step before sticking and falling over. Pyrrha shifted Nona to her other hip. The eyes of that pale mirror face fell on them, and Pyrrha said, So, what? John sent you? The person, Ianthe, the real Ianthe Naberius, after all, not the lovely-chinned corpse with the perfect hair, crossed over to them, lit from behind by the electric light. Up close she had skin like Honesty's, if Honesty had been put in a cave for maybe a million years, or perhaps like noodle skin when you parted the crimpled, curdly fur at the back of his neck. Who are you really? She asked, sounding genuinely curious. You had me fooled that you were the saint of duty with bits missing. I wasn't paying attention. Number 7 got him. I'm his leftover cavalier parts, Pyrrha Dve. Does that happen normally? No. Phew, said Ianthe, and then finally, No. No, John Gaius didn't send me. She came to stand in front of Kiriona Gaia, and they stared at each other, evenly and coldly, one hand on the handles of the rapiers each carried on their hip. For Ianthe Naberius carried a rapier too, worn on a jewelled belt atop her beautiful leather breeches, with a parchment-coloured shirt all swirled over by the softest-looking white material Nona had ever seen. It was like a rainbow had been put in the fridge, then woven into fabric. It settled over Ianthe Naberius's shoulders like a mist. It was so beautiful. She stood there, before the Corpse Prince, looking barely more alive than Kiriona was. Pyrrha said lowly,
Don't do anything stupid, kid.
Are you ever too late to come into my life and say that? Said Kiriona.
Ianthe, ignoring this interchange, said merely, Prince Kiriona Gaia.
Prince Ianthe Nibirius, said her opposite, and, Can you not fucking smoke in here?
It's a filthy habit, admitted the other prince. I didn't think you cared, though.
I don't, but there's like a million fire detectors.
In a show of obsequious obedience, rolling her eyes, Ianthe took her gold finger bones and stubbed out the cigarette on her real thin flesh hand, then tossed the discarded butt over her shoulder, where it smouldered on the stones. Crux started to make a noise like a tea kettle filled with soup. Ianthe ignored him. A terrible hunger had sharpened her like a knife. Did you bring my sister?
Upstairs, said the corpse prince, and thumbed vaguely somewhere over her shoulder. You can pick her up whenever. She came on her own. I didn't have to use my attraction or my charm.
You don't have either. God, it's like she wants me to catch her, marvelled Ianthe, that ill-shampooed slut.
Sixth house bigwigs are up there too. Don't know if we want them, said the corpse prince laconically. The rest of the house is parked outside the Ur system. Should be easy enough to sweep them up. Not that we've got the people. Anyway, I don't think Dad even wants them. They'd only depress him.
It had slowly dawned on Nona, by the look of everyone else caught in the yellow muck, it was dawning on them too, that this conversation was not being carried out in a way anyone had expected. Ianthe reached out. Her sleeve fell away from her wrist, and Nona saw a strange fat bracelet ringing her bony wrist, a braided, hyper-coloured cord in shades that were somehow even uglier than the cords she had seen before, in her class, and on the wrist of... Friendship bracelets! She fairly shouted. They're wearing friendship bracelets! Ianthe grasped Kiriona's wrist, and Kiriona pulled free of the sticky yellow muck as easily and as neatly as if it were dust. They stood there, hands clasping each other's wrists in their beautiful polished boots and their jewelled white swords, a matched pair of princes, one dead and one barely looking better. They tapped each other on the knuckles, did something complicated with their thumbs, and stood angled toward each other, easy and familiar, as though they had stood beside each other a million times. Paul said quietly, Harrowhark's body is nearly dead. Are you going to get us inside the tomb or not? Long straps of that sticky, taffy, textured fat snapped out and wrapped around Nona's ankles. She was jerked out of Pyrrha's arms, rolled up in a thick wad of it, and rolled over and over, nauseated and panicked until she came to a stop right beside that polished boot. It shone so highly that Nona could see her face in it, and the distorted reflection looked terrible, a blue-lipped, haggard version of herself she had never known. The face of the other girl, maybe. Not hers. A face distorted with fear. The fat dissolved, leaving nothing but a weird, moist feeling on the insides of her wrists. Ianthe was saying, I'm simply doing exactly what I think Harry would want me to do. Harry adores this ghastly old rock and its ghastly old inhabitant. Harry would be the first to say, No, I'm not worth it. Leave it shut. Don't you think, Ninth?
I try not to, said Kiriona modestly.
Both the Ianthe and Kiriona briefly fell about laughing. They slapped each other's shoulders in what seemed to be genuine mirth. Nona rolled an eye desperately toward Pyrrha and Paul and the two ancients. Pyrrha and Paul were still as statues.
Good to see you, said Ianthe quite kindly to Kiriona.
Yeah, same, said Kiriona with infectious good cheer. Anyway, let's open the tomb and get out of here.
For a moment, Ianthe kept laughing, and then she said, Wait, what?
That tomb's opening, now, said Kiriona.
You can't possibly be... Ninth?
for Kiriona had taken a few steps backward, away from Nona, in no danger of tripping over her, bathed in the yellow glow of the electric light reflecting off the fat. She drew her sword with an oily rattle, and Ianthe drew hers. Nona stared, transfixed at the edges of their swords. Ianthe said,
"You little three-way double-crosser."
"Haven't double-crossed anybody, let alone three times," said Kiriona.
"You've double-crossed God for one,"
Kiriona said.
"What?
John sent me, you over-gilded doorknob,"
Pyrrha said.
"Like hell he did."
"My sentiments exactly expressed," said Ianthe.
"No, he did," said the corpse prince. "I didn't sneak onto that ship for my health. Don't you see? This is my chance. We go in there, we open up the tomb, I take down whatever's inside. Electo, Annabelle, I don't care, whatever her name is. Boom, we're done. Dad won't be immortal anymore, but he says he doesn't care about that, and I believe him, Tridentarius. I'll be his cavalier. I'm the first. Hell, I'm his child and heir. Isn't this the neatest way? Are you going to help me or not?"
Ianthe had withdrawn. Even from below, Nona could see the horror and disgust writ large on her face. It had a lot to do with the chin.
"Oh, my God," she said softly. "You can't believe that. You're very stupid when you want to be, gonad, but you can't believe that."
"You know he's never recovered."
"Yes," said Ianthe. "Oh, I know.
If we weren't around, I don't know what he'd do."
"I do," said Ianthe. "Exactly the same thing he's doing right now, without trying to hide it, drowning his sorrows in whatever or whoever comes to hand. Do you know who I saw creeping out of his bedroom the other day? Grand Admiral Sarpedon, I shit you not."
"Oh, God, yuck," said Kiriona, looking highly diverted. "That's sick."
"Following a grand cavalcade of cohort officials, ensigns, etc."
"Yeah, but Sarpedon is old."
"That's your problem. Kiriona, you fat-headed wreck. John's older than our recorded time," said Ianthe.
"Yeah, but he doesn't look it, does he?" retorted Kiriona. "Sarpedon's, like, in his 50s? 60s? It's nasty. They should know how it looks. It looks sus. Anyway, that's my dad."
"You haven't had to live through an atom of the worst of it," said Ianthe. "You are an exasperating child and a moron. Stop making me argue with you. The important part of this, you gibbering bozo, is that the moment that door opens, you're not killing the monster inside. Give me 5 minutes. You're not becoming his cavalier. You're not fixing anything. You're signing our doom," snapped Ianthe. "He gets her back. You don't know what he'll become. You have no idea, and you've deluded yourself into believing him. And he's just tricking you. You know that, don't you? Are you trying to kid yourself? Is this about Harry after all?"
There was a deep, indrawn breath. Ianthe laughed and said,
"You don't have to breathe, you know.
You're so goddamn boring when you talk about Harrow Hark, so don't," said Kiriona. "Listen to you, big lady of the first. Leave Harrow to die. Don't open the tomb. What did you come here for? Stop playing the good son. You don't give a shit about anything except your own plans, you know. Your sister's upstairs. Take her and go. Let me fight this thing and win, or die trying. Who cares?"
"You let that monster out of its box," said Ianthe, "and you start us down a path nobody can save us from. If God truly wants her out, if Teacher set this all up, if he wants her..."
"Wants her? He told me to kill her. He said, make it quick, but kill her. Said me with my blood could do it. Said me with my blood, I was the only one."
Ianthe rounded on the corpse prince, and she gave her a ringing slap straight through the face. Kiriona did not stagger.
He loves her, Ianthe howled. John loves Alecto. John needs Alecto. Without that piece of goddamned fridge meat, he's nothing, and we need to keep him that way. The secret was told. The secret was out. The middle brain disappeared. Nona unravelled. The first thing that happened was that a big slit opened up above her baby heart. She gushed up blood against the front of her black shirt, then more slits through her middle, then in and out of her mortal insides, her unshapely organs. All the stuff inside her guts was hammered through. She was slit 1,000 times, 1,000,000. Her skin erupted in blood through all the pores of her face. It poured out behind the backs of her knees, her ears, her armpits, anything glandular. She choked up blood. Both tower princes had whirled around, dropped down to their knees beside her. One said, "Her neck! Get her neck!" But as fast as she could be stitched together, she came apart. The baby body was coming apart. A slim brown hand was at her cheek.
"Keep it together. Wherever you are, idiot, I know you can hear me. Keep it together."
Above their voices and the blood and the dim sweetness of the pain, she heard Paul say,
"Pyrrha, go."
A gunshot. The pale yellow figure crumpled over next to Nona's bust-up body, covered in Nona's fluids. She jerked and went into a spasmodic fit, shuddering and juddering as though she could somehow vibrate out of her skin. Paul dropped to Nona's side with a clinical glance at Crown's frothing, screaming sister and said nothing more than,
"Effective." "I was saving that bullet for John," said Pyrrha. "Herald bullets don't grow on trees. Wake made that for me, or I stole it from her. Same difference. Paul, can we... is there still..."
Paul sounded detached, strange above her. It was as though she were underwater. She yearned to be underwater.
"Open the door," they said. "Now."
Nona felt herself lifted. Kiriona's arms beneath her shoulders, Pyrrha's beneath her hips. Why were they carrying her that way? Why was Pyrrha saying,
"Keep her arm, Paul, her arm's coming off."
The rock loomed so big above, so awful in the electric light. There were so many people standing above her, her body, the baby's body, the baby with the big black eyes, the scrap of meat with the purple mouth. Pyrrha was saying,
"This isn't the real entrance, right? It can't be."
And someone, the old soldier, was saying,
"No, the true rock, so it is said, is down a corridor. But I can't lift this. I'm no adept."
An enormous sound. The rock rolling away, a great grinding noise, Paul saying,
"Not a problem,"
but the old man hoarsely,
"The traps, the thieves' traps, the snares."
Again, Paul,
"Let me."
She had been down this corridor. She had squeezed through this crack in the rock. Not a passageway, not at that point. John had told her he had something to show her. He had said, "It's very pretty, you'll like it." Paul's voice again, Camilla's voice, Palamedes' voice.
"Most of them are disabled. Neat work, whoever did it."
Maybe the body blacked out. The next thing she heard was Kiriona urgently saying,
take it from anywhere, take all of it."
"My lady,"
the old man was saying feebly.
"My lady, my girl child."
"I don't need all of it, but I need to keep it wet,"
Pyrrha was saying.
"You can't spoof this. Cass and Mercy and I worked on cell thanergy. We need thanergy, fresh thanergy, to activate."
John loved her. She was John's cavalier. She loved John, for she so loved the world that she had given them John. For the world so loved John that she had been given. For John had so loved her that he had made her she. For John had loved the world.
"Kill me," said Kiriona.
"No, you're dead," said Paul. "You won't produce a reaction."
"Me," said Pyrrha. "Take me and Gideon. If Wake had just asked me, I might have done it in the first place. Died here with her for this."
"Take me, you fools," said Crux.
She hadn't come on purpose. The scrap of black-eyed meat had asked for it. The chain of a kiss, the ice that burnt the flesh of the mouth that had stuck to the mouth that was frozen. The teardrop on the hand that John had fashioned. Someone said something. The old man, Crux, the child, Crux, barely 100 years old, was saying hoarsely,
"Fix me, and I am taken by the unknown. Kill me for the love of the reverend daughter. Oh, do you think you are the only one who knows how to die, Nav? I knew you were dead to see you. I will commit this apocalyptic sin. I will die for her. She is my nursling. I am the only one who knows how to die for the reverend daughter Harrow Hark Nona Jasimus."
"Good,"
said someone so savagely that it sounded like a new voice altogether.
"Good. Die. Die for her. It's the only goddamn good you'll ever do her. It's all any of you ever knew how to give her. You could have lived for her, but you didn't know how."
"You never knew what of what you talked of, but ran your tongue anyway," said Crux. "All our sacrifices, our scrimping, the blood of the tomb keeper."
Paul was saying,
"Are you certain?"
Aglamine said,
"Marshal, you have a duty to Dreba and to the Os. This is my duty as your..."
And Kiriona,
"No, no, I won't let you."
And Crux,
my rights, I am dying anyway."
"Oh, just let him go," snarled Kiriona. "He wants to die. I'll do it. I've wanted to do this for years."
John had said, "It's so beautiful. Come and look," she had said. "There are almost no beautiful things left. Where is Anastasia? Let me talk to Anastasia."
"Then do it, coward," Crux said. "Do it. The knife is before you. The work has been done."
"Did you know I'm God's child?" Kiriona demanded. "Did you know all the things you did, all the shit you pulled, every single thing you did, every lock you snapped on me, every cuff you put on me, every crappy plate of food you put in front of me, every word, every look? Did you know I was the real true blue daughter of the Emperor? I want you to know that. I want you to know what I am."
"You remain what you are," said Crux, "a worthless millstone hung about my darling's neck. You were born to make her suffer. You died as you lived, Gideon Nav, a disappointment to me and to God."
There was a wet, meaty sound. The old man exhaled. It was dark. Then there was light, bright, cold, electrifying like death, and the noise of another rock, slowly, agonizingly grinding away. And Kiriona kept saying, "It didn't feel good. Fuck! It didn't feel good. Why didn't it feel good?" A rising, hysterical note. "Why didn't it feel good, you fucking old, you hideous, cruel, you bastard! Why can't I?" Glowworms, she had told John. "Technically beetles," said John. "But I always loved them. Narrow beetles with long strands hanging off them, a carpet of shifting, dead, winking lights at the top of the grave. Greenish, orangish, yellowish, moving over one another silently with those long filaments hanging down. Something came off the baby's body. A foot, maybe. Paul jammed it back on. And the water, the huge pool of real salt water, where she had knelt and drank. She moved the baby's body apart from the others. They could not stop her. She stepped into the water. Ah, that was good. The water was ice cold. It froze the baby's heart in its tracks. But she was moving her now and did not need her heart. Someone said, "Let her go. It's gravity. Let her go." And those voices were dim now. She could no longer distinguish them. Most human voices sounded alike, after all. They were not beautiful. The waters parted for her, and it became possible to walk, crunching through the bones at the bottom. The bones at the bottom. What did they make her think of?
John and she had swum to the Santa hummock rising out of the pool. Not an island, not really. An outcropping, with the marble pillars and the marble top and the long, low marble table. He said he thought it was a nice place to be, to lie down. She had liked hard things to lie down on. It was hard to endure having a spine. And there she was. A long echo down the tunnel. The lictor with the broken body, screaming, still in crazed agony, but getting closer. There she was. John had made her so ugly, so unbearably ugly. The terrible face with the terrible arms and legs and the terrible middle part and the terrible hair and the terrible ears. The nose too short, the ears too brief. But there she was, and within her, the child asleep with the strange sword. The sword, her sword. Her own edge had been pushed out, her swinging edge, her toy, her plain bladed sword, and her body was chained up. "No!" someone howled from the shore. "No! No!" She looked back beyond, and she saw Anastasia, tucked where nobody would find her. Anastasia, all bones, not really Anastasia. But Anastasia's body, without the meat on it, snuggled right into the curve of the rock, ready to close the door whenever it was opened. She remembered Anastasia. Her vision swam. Her heart was in her throat.
"Well, happy birthday to me, I guess," sighed Nona.
And Nona tumbled forward onto the icy, dead breast of the body.
Epilogue.
When the rock that had been made meat awoke in a body, it cried out aloud, saying, "You!" Then it broke the chains that were upon its right wrist, and the right wrist broke with them. It broke the chains that were upon its left wrist, and the left wrist also. So followed the chains upon the right ankle and upon the left, until its arms and its legs and the chains were broken all as one. When it raised its terrible head, the chains around the neck collapsed into dust, and it cried, "Ah, ah, ah!" At the breaking of the chains and of the bones, one of the children there offered violence to her, appearing on the altar and raising her weapon high. But the black-eyed infant collapsed on the altar, chid her sharply in a clear voice, saying, "What is this that thou wouldst do, Tridentarius? Touch her, and our vow will come to nothing, and I will slay you where you stand." To which the first child said, "Thou knowest not what thou dost." And the second child answered, "Not lately, but now." And the first child asked, "Dost thou oppose me, and thou half dead?" And the second child said, "I am as one half dead, but you would be two halves dead, bitch." To which the first child said, "My sweet, I only die of longing for thee." And the other child said, "Then perish." Upon which the body that had been rock rose from the altar and struck the child who had offered violence to her with one broken hand, forgetting the sword in the other, so that the child who offered violence was not slain, but was cast into the water like a detestable thing. And many skeletons emerged from the bones of the bier and from the walls of the tomb. But when the sword was raised, they fled. When the broken feet touched the stone around the tomb, they were mended, and when the broken hands raised the sword, they were mended also. But the body itself was not fully awake, and stumbled on the steps at the bier, crying, "John! John!" but did not fall. And there was a crowd of dead children there. They were striving loudly against living children on the far-off shore of the tomb. The body did not understand how this had come to pass, yet when one on the shore called, "Alecto! Alecto!" then the body remembered and was mightily dashed in the memory of Alecto, so that all their sleep was perished with a noise. And Alecto said, "Pyrrha, He laid me down as an appeasement to them. He fed you to them as an appeasement to them. But he has never appeased me. And now all he has done was teach me how to die. But Pyrrha did not hear above the noise. Then Alecto remembered the vow, and turned back upon the altar to face the second child, and raised the sword with wrath in her heart, for they meant to bring destruction upon her. But when the black-eyed infant showed her countenance to Alecto, Alecto recalled her, for it was a face once dreamed in Alecto's dream, and Alecto stayed the sword. The child rose and said,
"O corse of the locked tomb, I have loved thee all my life with mine whole soul and with mine whole strength. I would to God that I find grace in thy eyes. Destroy me according to thy word, for I love thee."
Alecto was angry and raised her up and kissed her. The child did not cry out, though blood fell from her lips and tongue, and she was wounded sore. For Alecto knew not how to kiss, except such as it involved the mouth and teeth. And Alecto said to her, "Why are you not appeased? That is how meat loves meat." The child was silent, but her blood was on Alecto's lips, and through that blood, Alecto was made to understand what it was, and was astonished exceedingly. Alecto put away wrath and said, "Thou art the blood of the tomb-keeper." The child answered,
"Yes."
Alecto said, "The line of Anastasia is unbroken yet." The child answered,
"Through sin and iniquity, yes."
Alecto said, "I am very sorry about Samael." The child made no answer. Alecto said, "I remember my vows. As I swore to Anastasia, I swear to you, I am in your service until you bid me the favour, and whatsoever you appoint I shall perform and consider the vow rendered. This is what I promised until such a time as you deal with me as you see fit." The child was afraid and said,
"My hands are too stained, and I am too lowly."
So Alecto, wearied of talking, kneeled upon the rock and offered up the sword to her, and placed the child's hand upon the blade, so that it received also the red blood of the child. This made the child exceeding faint, but it did not swoon of weariness, which strength pleased Alecto, who said, "Notwithstanding, I offer you my service." To which a voice on the opposite side of the shore was raised, exceeding wrath, and Alecto heard it shout in a very great shout, "Get in line, thou big slut!" Afterward, Alecto went down to the ship and stood before John, purposing to travel through the river, and was grieved to find it yet dead. John was asleep and not in his garments, unshaved and still drunken. The child, who accepted the blade and thereupon fainted with hunger and thirst, was thrown over one of Alecto's arms, a deep sleep like death upon her, and in Alecto's other hand was the iron sword. And so Alecto took that iron sword, and with one hand pierced John's chest with it, even to the heart. At which John awakened and said,
"Annabel, good morning."
The End. This book was read for you by Maura Quirk, a member of SAG-AFTRA. We hope you have enjoyed this production of Nona the Ninth by Tamsin Muir. Recorded books are available wherever audiobooks are sold. Thank you for listening to Recorded Books.